Simon's going on vacation today. Is it vacation or is it your honeymoon?
Vacation. See, we're meeting up with my parents at some point, and so my wife's big rule was our honeymoon can in no way include either of our parents, which I feel like is a fair rule.
I think that's rule number one.
Yeah, so it's not a honeymoon.
Didn't you see the first season of White Lotus? That's the whole point. Don't do that, or else you'll do a murder.
So yeah, just a trip. Portugal, southern Spain. Can't wait.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
I'd say I'd come back tanned, but I'm a ginger, so I will come back sunburned.
You will not have a tan.
No, God, no. Absolutely.
I think that's
zero
a
chance.
Lock of the century.
You can try.
No, it's not.
Put in the effort.
Yeah, you know, I have enough history of trying, and it just comes up short every time.
I will say, though, as a very pasty, ghost-faced paste
man,
gross guy, that the best thing to come out of the pandemic for me personally was that I got to spend a lot of time outside during the summers.
Sure.
Because I got to go spend time at my mom's. I basically went for a month and a half. I was basically living stepbrother's life, where I was living at home, mom, meatloaf, the whole thing.
Well,
you know? Just, actually, that's not stepbrothers. That's old school. Mom, meatloaf.
It is.
Sorry to those. See,
good save, though.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. But I was living that life. You know, robe,
pool,
do the show from Arm Prior, Ontario, move to the pool for the rest of the day, hang out with my brother, drinks, maybe baseball on a phone or
That's
something like that, paying halfway attention and doing a show the following day. It was pretty sweet. I did love it. But being outside every day and just building up the exposure and taking the odd burn, it'll probably come back to bite me someday. But now I do tan slightly better.
Okay.
I used to be like you. I used to be like you, where nothing would ever happen other than burn, peel, repeat, burn, peel, repeat. You just have a daily, you got to work on it. It's genuinely.
Got to put in the reps.
Bro, it is like the gym. You have to, you think you're seeing results quickly. You're not. You're not like that. You're not built that way. Neither is Joe. We're actually a very pasty crew in here. This is a very,
we need
Pete in here.
Like,
it's way too pasty in here. But yeah, day by day, little by little, progress by progress. By the end of the summer, I could not believe it.
Wow.
I was blown away. Yeah. And now, now happens for me.
Okay.
And if it can happen for me, it can happen for you.
There's hope
close
for
to
you,
the
Simon.
Immortal words of J-Rock, J the ROC. Anyway, baseball's having a moment.
Yeah.
Baseball's sure having a for real moment right now. Mm-hmm. And I know that this city is different than the rest of the planet because when our baseball team gets hot, the whole city completely changes during the summer.
Yeah.
When we have a hot baseball team, the city, the Rogers Center essentially becomes the biggest patio in town.
Yep.
And everybody's there, and you get those wonderful Friday nights and those Saturdays where the building is packed, marquee games, building is packed, it gets loud in there. Now the stadium is going to have some renovations, which I'm pretty excited about. I've seen a few photos. There's a couple things that I'm not sure about. Like, they're selling tickets to
you can just
standing
like
room
around.
Only where you can just sort of walk around like it's the bar.
Yeah.
And I'm going, yeah, but wasn't the whole point of this that if you were in your seats, you could stand up and go to these areas and hang out in a different spot?
Mm-hmm.
And now if they're...
It's not a bad idea, though. Like, it's not terrible.
I need
terrible.
To see it.
True.
Because I don't want to go to those... The whole point of what sucked is that, first of all, the area that they had, the flight deck, whatever iterations it was. It was always the flight deck.
The flight deck.
Yeah, but you'd go to the flight deck, and there was 20 spots to stand, and it would be full every single time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what I'm really hoping doesn't happen is by adding those extra tickets that it causes those areas to congest a bit.
So you negate the renovations
almost. Well, I told you guys when I went to my last Leaf game, it's been a little while since I was in the 300s, I know. It's, I felt poor. The Leafs will make you feel poor, though.
Yeah,
because
that's for sure.
You can
sit anywhere and make you feel poor.
Yeah, that's it. Anyway, so... and it was only because the group I was with wanted to sit up there, okay? Just so everyone's clear.
Okay.
Wasn't your choice.
Yeah, just kidding. I don't care. I actually like sitting up high in hockey games. It's really hard to find bad spots in an arena. And sometimes you can actually sit too close in a corner and feel like you're further part of the game. Anyway, you leave during the intermissions and you try to meet people, and it's a nightmare. It takes you the entire intermission just to get over to wherever their section is.
Yeah.
And then trying to meet for some of those beer areas, they fill up too, and it's too much.
Yeah.
And so I'm a little worried, I'm a little nervous about that happening at the Rogers Center, because all of that stuff is essentially in one place. And if they're selling added tickets and then people in their seats are also getting up, I don't know. I just, I have a little bit of hesitation in terms of leaping for joy, which was the pretty much consensus when people saw it, because they went, oh my God, that's such a great option. That's going to be cheap. That's going to be awesome. I can't wait to do that.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, who is always going to be buying a seated ticket.
You have to see it to believe it type thing.
Well, for sure. Yeah. But I also know that I'm going to have a seat.
Sure.
I'm never going to buy the just standing room only walk around ticket.
Right.
And I've, the other thing too is that's already done by people who buy tickets for the 300 level and then just do that anyway. So now you're adding the 300 level tickets that are not people who are going to be sitting in their seats for most of the game.
Mm-hmm.
The 100 level people that want to get up and meet and are excited by the new stuff.
Yeah.
Plus standing room, walking room only. We'll see.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, we'll see. It sounds good in theory. We'll see when it's a packed Friday night, what it feels like in those areas. And when you're trying to get a neutral on a hot day and it takes you 45 minutes to do so and you don't really have anywhere to stand.
Mystery innings.
We will see.
Right.
Anyway, the sport as a whole, we're having a moment.
Yeah.
We're having a moment here. So yesterday I'm listening to Jeff Blair, right? Because it's a great show. Him and Barker. And they've got on David Sampson, who's an awesome guest.
Yeah.
You're wearing the Florida Marlins hat today, Simon. That's him. That's Mr. Florida Marlins. So Blair asks a question, which I think is one that's been pondered about for a while now, which is the juice worth the squeeze with this tournament? Is it worth upsetting clubs, and is it worth potential injuries? And I think there's actually some negative attention for certain players, given the conversations that I've had on the show with even guys like Ernie Witt about, hey, why aren't some of these guys going?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's good for Jordan Romano's image or anybody on the Blue Jays that didn't go, Zach Pop, that we're aware you wouldn't go lace them up for Canada.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good for you. So is the juice worth the squeeze of having this tournament? And last night, well, actually first, David Sampson told him, not quite yet, but we're close. And guess what?
Yeah.
Last night, bang!
Yeah.
Ten hours later.
We are there. World Baseball Classic. What a moment. Now, all it took was that. One hot moment where all of us care, and it's not just one country that cares. It's not just people going, oh, this is the USA's tournament. Yeah, okay,
totally.
Great.
Yeah.
Cool. Because I've checked out of Olympics before with the USA just being so good. What year was it where they had their one close game against Australia and then they just body bagged everybody else? Mm-hmm. Anyway, this was fun.
Yeah.
I don't know why they pitched to Ohtani to lead off the ninth inning.
Yeah, that's a little absurd.
But for those of you that are not aware, Japan is down a run going into the ninth inning.
Mm-hmm.
And Shohei Ohtani, the game's biggest and brightest star, he hits a leadoff double, and Japan rallies to win in walk-off fashion against a Mexico team we got a good look at, I guess, because Canada played their biggest game against them and it was disappointing, but a really, outside of beating Canada, entertaining, plucky, scrappy Mexico team had already beat the United States and was setting up for a cool rematch between these two.
Yeah.
Anyway, now we've got Ohtani and Trout, which, Joe, you pointed out in the email.
Box office.
And all I could think was, Ohtani's going to move on to bigger and better things, okay? Mike Trout has trapped himself in L.A., and he's just decided this is the life I want for myself. This is the biggest game of Mike Trout's career. This is going to potentially be the biggest baseball moment in his career. And having these two pitted against each other all of a sudden is a really cool angle. It's one of the greatest American teams against the Japanese team that clearly is loaded with a ton of talent and cares immensely about this tournament. I love it.
Yeah.
Ohtani versus Trout, the greatest American team ever assembled versus the greatest star in baseball right now, who's saying that he wants to pitch in this game.
Sick.
So sick. If you're an Angels fan, though, you're just terrified. You're going, oh, please. Please, oh, please.
Yeah.
Please, oh, please, please, oh, please.
Healthy. Please stay healthy.
I at least love the first few weeks of the baseball season when I have my hope.
Yeah.
When I can at least squint and say, maybe.
The Angels start off okay.
Altuve is out for 2 months for the Astros.
Yep. Thumb injury.
And you're going, hey, there's hype about the Mariners. That's the team that made the playoffs for the first time in forever last year. They needed 18 wildcard teams for them to finally scrap and claw their way in and get one spot. Angels fans at least have a little morsel to dream about a morsel. You have Shohei and you have Mike Trout.
Yeah.
Okay. These two guys going head to head. That is fun. That is must-see TV for anyone other than Simon, who's going on his honeymoon with his parents. That's clearly, he's like, our one rule was no honeymoon with the parents. And it's like, well, when did you have it? It's like, so this isn't a mulligan.
We're still going to have a honeymoon later.
Right. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, later. No, that's cool.
If
there's one thing women love, it's going on vacation with their significant others, parents, and being told their honeymoon can wait. No, you're crushing it. That's a really sweet move by you, Simon. Anyway, Shohei versus Trout is fun. Baseball is having a moment. Pitch clock coming in, speeding up these games, and actually delivering us contests that are under 2.5 hours. Wow. All of a sudden, kind of feels hot.
Yeah.
Feels like they're making really positive moves as some of their competitors, I would say the NBA and the NHL. Well, the NHL, I know we think it's a competitor up here in the States. They're like, you guys do that?
They're like, what's hockey?
Yeah, Tom Haberstroh's on the line right now, and he's going, don't say that. No one down here is fired up. No one. We got like 6 markets that know what's going on with you guys up there, and everybody else's help. But yeah, basketball is having all this stuff about stars resting and these weird stats that I want to talk to, like Haberstroh about, where it's just, how are we measuring now these offenses? When the Sacramento Kings have the greatest offense in NBA history now, you go, what? Okay, what's happening here? And Julius Randle last night scored 57, I want to say. And this kind of happens routinely to the point where I don't care as much about it. Mm. I used to freak out when somebody scored 55 points in a game. Nuts. Now, it's all right. It's cool. I like it. I'll watch it. I'll watch the Dawkins highlights. But either way, hockey, same thing. Taking steps back. Baseball, doing some modern stuff. Having some good international play, which hockey should learn from, and all of a sudden, there's some real momentum by the sport. We'll see if it translates into the ratings and into attendance, but either way, it's been awesome. And yeah, I mentioned it. Tom Haberstroh is on the line from the excellent Basketball Illuminati Underdogs podcast. Creator of Count the Things, just the man, Tom Haberstroh. What's up, bro?
What's going on?
Hey, so I got to tell you, I have a confession, which is that I did a pretty big rant yesterday against the very core statement of your Underdogs podcast, mission statement.
Oh, what happened?
I just said,
you're probably right.
No,
just saying.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Thank you. I agree. I am right. I was just making the case that for me, it's worse to watch the one seed like Purdue lose to the 16 seed. I don't get as much joy out of it as other people. When I see that, I just feel heartbroken for the Purdue kids who had this incredible year and are going to have to carry that for the rest of their lives. And then the 16 seed, I know, is going to get waxed in the very next round, which, they put up a better fight, I guess, than I thought they were going to. They played Florida Atlantic team, which I don't think is going to end up winning this tournament either. But that, to me, it's worse to see the 16 seed beat the one seed. I'd rather just see the favorites in this situation come through.
Oh, man. I mean, that sounds like to me that, you know, some people like steak, some people like fish, some people are vegan, right? Like you have
Are you calling me the last one? Wait, is that what you're saying?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think what we're saying here is that, you know, you prefer the juggernaut to win, and that you don't like the Rudy movie. You don't like Little Giants. You don't like the underdog, which is okay. No, yeah. I think the NBA does things differently. The NBA makes sure, as much as it can, that if you're the better team, you're going to play in a 7-game series and you're going to assert yourself and win 4 of those 7 games. It doesn't do the one and done tournament like the NCAA does, perhaps because it likes having the Lakers and the Celtics juggernauts going at it with Magic and Larry Bird, and they wanted Steph and LeBron. I'm not saying they rigged that so that those two teams can play in the finals, but I'm saying the NBA makes sure in its formatting of the games that it's a longer series. And in college basketball, it's an amazing thing when you watch these do or die games. I just think it's a great theater, great television. The NBA takes a different tack and says, we want the best teams at the end. And so I think that's what you prefer, right, is the NBA format where 7-game series all the way through, and you see the best teams that endure the postseason, they meet up at the end.
Yeah, I love that for professional sports. It's why I like the bye even for the NFL. I like the reward of having the best team be able to sit for a week. And I think if you look at the numbers, It's like over 80% of the teams that get the bye end up making the Super Bowl. I like that. I do love the NBA's format, and I get a special feeling whenever I'm watching the NBA Finals because it is usually the best two teams, or a lot of times it is the best two teams. That does make it a little bit more special to me, the finals itself, rather than what we have up here in the NHL, or I shouldn't say up here, like you guys don't have hockey, but where we care about it more, right? The Stanley Cup playoffs, one of my biggest points of contention with it is that it does feel a lot more random, and you end up with Stanley Cup finals a lot of times that are far worse than the first round. And the tournament, I think, is the best because, yeah, the first round, the first weekend, or the first 4 days is clearly the best part of the tournament. I don't think it's so much that I don't want to root for the underdog ever. I actually normally find myself rooting for the underdog. I think that's like a psychological thing with most of us. Just to me, it's that the one seed in particular, the 16 seed, I go, the 16 team isn't going to be the Cinderella story that goes all the way. I can't buy it. I can't believe that they're going to end up winning multiple rounds. And then, yeah, I just feel so bad for the guys on Purdue or the guys that were on Virginia when they lost, that they've got to carry that for their entire lives, that everything about their lives has been geared towards being excellent at basketball. And then whenever they have to tell people like what they did, they go, oh, Zach Edey, especially, he's 7'6" or whatever, his whole life he's going to stand out. They're going to go, aren't you that big loser from Purdue? The poor kid. So that's where I feel a little bit of empathy. Okay, you mentioned it, though, that the league tries to gear these matchups to happen. And I wanted to start with some other stuff, but let's just go there right away, which is you had a viral tweet about a year ago that was actually, it's almost a year ago to the day, which makes this really perfect, about, hey, how the NBA, you devised a system of basically calculating a ref rating. I mean, maybe it's better if you explain it rather than I do, even though you actually wrote in the tweet, I think it was something like even a fourth grader could understand this, so it is pretty simple. But essentially, it's that, yeah, the more public teams in the NBA, they will generally get the more veteran officials, the better officials, guys who have done finals games, guys who do playoff games, guys with, yeah, veterans in the crew versus teams that, yeah, like the Toronto Raptors, for example, I think we're bottom five in the rankings. And I'm curious if, you know, you've gone through this exercise again and you found a similar pattern of results a year later.
Yeah. So thanks for bringing this up. And just for the record, I'm not saying that the NBA is rigging playoff matchups so that you get LeBron and Steph. I'm just saying more likely that you get the LeBrons and the Stephs in the finals because of the way it's structured. But that's like really interesting to me just on the playoff format front, but the referee stuff, it's out there. It's public information that the NBA gives certain crew role assignments for different referees. So like they post every day, every morning, you can see for the Toronto Raptors game, which referee is going to be the leader of the crew, which is going to be the referee two, which is the second in command, and which one is going to be the umpire. And so the umpire is the third. It's usually the rookie refs or the really inexperienced refs that are just breaking into the league. It turns out that when you look at those referee assignments, the leader, the referee two, and the umpire, turns out that like there's certain patterns emerge. And one of those patterns that I identified was that typically when a team is on national TV, the NBA treats it like a playoff game, where basically they put their playoff referees on that game or a really strong referee crew on that game. When I say really strong, I say basically that this referee crew by the NBA is got more playoff experience. They've got more finals experience. And essentially, if you're the Toronto Raptors, that you're not on national TV all that much, that also means that you're missing out on those top referee crews. And last year, when I ran this study, at the time, the Toronto Raptors were bottom five in referee rating. I've now called it like referee score because I'm not actually rating the referees. I'm just giving them a score on a 5-point scale. And last year, the Raptors at this point in the season had one of the worst referee ratings in the NBA. This year, that actually has improved a little bit. So now the referee score for the Toronto Raptors this season is 13th best in the NBA, so middle of the pack. They've moved up from the bottom. Congratulations. Moved up from the bottom. They finished actually 20th last season. Right now at this point, it's 13th. And what's really interesting, too, is looking at the data. The Toronto Raptors referees, the referees that are assigned to Toronto Raptors games, on average, the crew has 33 years of experience, which is actually pretty high. It's the third highest average in the NBA. It also has the third most playoff experience of any NBA team this season. So a lot of fans like to think that their referees have it out against them, or the NBA has it out against them, but they get bad referee crews. But in this case, at this point in the season, the Raptors have actually gotten a better share of referees than they did last year. But there's more to this Ben Taylor, Fred VanVleet story than what meets the eye. And I think that's really, really interesting. Something I've uncovered there too.
Yeah. And I want to get into that. All I will say is that the Raptors getting improved officiating is a devastating blow for all of the listeners of this, because, oh my God, Tom, you're aware of Raptors Twitter? You've seen them out there before? You hear how Tom got silent? He was like, please don't bring this up. Please don't drag me into this. I don't want to go there. I don't want to be a part of this. It is a fan base that thinks the world is against them constantly. And the national TV game stuff, I've always been kind of a, hey, this doesn't matter that much. Don't freak out about not getting a Christmas Day game. It's actually nice for all the media people here that work those Raptors games that they don't have to do them. And I do empathize with them on Christmas. I've never really been a big, you need to be the ESPN game, especially considering up here we have broadcast rules that prevent us from getting those broadcasts anyway. Like, we get our local broadcast no matter what. So I've never really understood the massive desire for it, other than the fact that we're Toronto and we have a bit of an inferiority complex where we always basically want to be Canadian, but we also want to be the States. It's this weird little brother thing that we've got going on. But now knowing right. that you don't get the better officials, yeah, there is kind of a little bit of a something to it. But let's go in. You had, I think it's Don Vadden. I was listening to your podcast last night, actually. It was really, really interesting. I didn't know the stuff about basically that they can recommend an off-court meeting between players and officials. And I did start thinking about your ref rating, because why would they put Fred VanVleet and Ben Taylor together so often when these two guys can't stand each other?
Yeah, so we had Don Vadden, who is the NBA director of officials, a longtime NBA referee, and was running the referee program with the NBA for quite a while. And now he's retired, and he joined our podcast, Basketball Illuminati. He's been on the show a few times, and he was really excellent, kind of giving the backdrop of what it's like to work in the NBA front office, assigning referees and trying to, you know, manage a really contentious situation between Ben Taylor and Fred VanVleet. While he's not in the NBA referee circles right now, he can kind of speak to experience about when these dust-ups happen publicly or even privately, that they can arrange a meeting, off-court meeting between the referee and the player in question, and to try to just soothe a lot of those wounds, right? Like try to come to some sort of understanding that, look, this, it's not personal. It's fine. It's just tempers flare, emotions run high. That's okay. But what's interesting to me about this story is, you know, I think a lot of Raptors fans were out for blood and said, like, Ben Taylor should be demoted, or Ben Taylor should be fined, or Ben Taylor should be suspended, whatever it is.
Jail
and I think a lot of
is actually
fans,
the one that most advocated for, but yes.
Jail, yes, yeah. For life. Okay. Yeah. I disagree with that assessment, yeah. But I will say that Ben Taylor, since that Fred VanVleet rant, in which he called him out with some very harsh language for sure, the NBA has actually demoted Ben Taylor in his assignments. So in the last five games, Ben Taylor has only been the crew chief once. He's been the referee four times since that game, since that rant, which is a real abnormality with Ben Taylor. If you look at his previous 52 games this season, Ben Taylor was the crew chief in 41 of those games. Basically, four out of five games, he was the crew chief. But in the last five games since that rant, the NBA said, you know what, you're going to be the referee two in this one. And then again, referee two, he was the crew chief against the Celtics Houston game the other night. And then Ben Taylor was the referee two for the next two games. To put it in perspective, Ben Taylor hadn't been a referee two in back-to-back games all season. After the Fred VanVleet, it's happened twice. So the NBA, I don't know if that's intentional or whether that's just luck of the draw, but certainly the NBA has taken a different tack when it comes to Ben Taylor's assignments, whether that's punishment or whether that's just, hey, you need to chill out a little bit. One thing that's interesting about him too is that Ben Taylor is really tech happy. He had 26 technical foul calls issued this season, which is one of the highest rates in the league. Compare that to, say, Zach Zarba or James Capers. James Capers, a referee, longtime referee, finals referee. James Capers has given out 5 technicals this season. Ben Taylor has given out 26. Huge variance. And so I can see why Fred VanVleet was upset. And I do see a big change from the NBA in how they're handling Ben Taylor.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And yeah, correlation doesn't mean causation, but it's hard not to link those two things together, given, yeah, the context that you just put it in. And I think if you're the league, it's hard because that's not something you want to push publicly to the fans. And, you know, one of the things about your podcast and that you always sort of illustrate is that, yeah, the league really likes to keep the officiating out of the news, out of any type of cycle. They want it to be pretty secretive because, yeah, we live in the gambling era, the conspiracy era, the Twitter era, where these things can just steam, like they can just snowball and get completely out of control. But there is part of this where I go, if you're the league, don't you want this sort of, do you want this communicated to the players where one guy comes out publicly? And maybe you're right because they have this, and there was a bunch of players around the league that jumped on and did the whole Fred was right thing. I'm curious where they go from here on this, because if I'm a player, I'm thinking, all right, anytime there's an official that's doing stuff like this and they make some calls against me, I can really go to the media, take that $30,000 fine and actually have an impact on this. Like it has been better for the Raptors since then. And yeah, they got their wish in terms of a pound of flesh from Ben Taylor. This feels like a pretty actually huge win for the players. I just wonder how they want this kind of communicated internally.
Yeah. And look, in talking to executives, coaches and players, they feel like they are talking to a wall sometimes when they're talking to the league office and the last 2-minute reports, the disagreements there where it seems like they're not getting their voice heard. And sometimes they lose, you know, an outlet. They feel like there's nowhere else to go. And with Fred VanVleet, it feels like that was something that was bubbling up for quite a while, that wasn't just about that game or that just wasn't just about referees. You know, you can talk about Fred VanVleet and his struggles this season and the Raptors not living up to expectations this year. He's probably one of the most frustrated players in the league. And so he's coming out with that rant. And then what was fascinating to me is it was only $30,000 fine.
Yes.
Whereas we talked about it with Ethan Strauss over at House of Strauss this past week. You know, he was expecting, and some people in the league were expecting a suspension, like a 1-game suspension for Fred VanVleet or a 6-figure fine.
I thought it was going to be a huge fine. I thought it was going to be a massive fine. And when I saw $30,000, I was shocked. I went, huh? Like, I was trying to look for precedents, and yeah, just it was a shockingly low fine, I will admit.
So then what does that say to the rest of the players? Like, if I can get hit with a $30,000 fine, this is worth it, right? So that might be the message that it sends. Although, like, Trae Young and I think Marcus Smart both said, like, go look at Fred VanVleet's rants. I'm not going to speak on it, but he said what I want to say. And so players haven't really gone nuclear on the referees like Fred VanVleet did. But I do think it's interesting seeing the response by the league is basically demoting Ben Taylor in his assignments. He was one of the top officials heading into that game. And since that rant, they basically told him, hey, you need to take a seat from the varsity. You're going down to JV.
To be honest, I think that a lot of fans would probably like to hear this. If you're an opposing fan, you're facing the Raptors in the very next game. You're thinking conspiracy stuff if this is playoffs. But overall, what do most people preach they want more of is just accountability with the officials. They feel like what you just said, which is that you're talking to a wall. And this happens across all sports at times where you feel like, hey, what is the accountability? And refs always counter with, well, we're scored on these things, and the better we do, the more playoff games we get, and the more playoff games we get, the more money we get, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, it always does feel like when things are really blown or a ref does do something, yeah, like this, where it does, I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility. Maybe that's not Taylor trying to go out there and screw Fred VanVleet over. But I think Vadden put it perfectly in your podcast of some people just don't mesh, and having those two on the floor together, he probably owns some culpability for the way that this thing is going and for Fred exploding the way that he did. And so, yeah, I end up thinking this is a good thing. It's just, yeah, that fine line of trying to figure out what you do from here now, like how much of a precedent this is going to set moving forward for the next time there's an official that needs to be dealt with this way, or the next time a player makes it personal between a referee and himself.
Yeah, let's see what happens in the playoffs.
Yeah.
I do think that we will see when, you know, the stakes get much higher. And for the Raptors, like, every game matters, right? Every game is the difference between being a sixth seed or out of the play-in tournament. So I think we'll see a lot more of these types of things pop up in the playoffs when the stakes are higher. And I do think that, like, on some level, it might be that the NBA felt that Ben Taylor might have had a quick trigger, or that he's giving out too many technicals, and that Fred VanVleet was speaking a little bit, you know, over the top, but there might have been some truth in that. And so, in the fact that he, you know, ruins the flow to the game or something like that, is that the NBA might be like, look, you know, this is an opportunity for us to just, like, say, hey, chill out a little bit. And it's interesting to see. I haven't pulled up his technical log since that game, but given the assignments, it does seem like the NBA is putting him on ice a little bit. And you know what? Like, the officiating is going to be a huge story in every playoffs, in every postseason, every year. It's a huge deal. I just think in the betting era, in the social media era, I do think that this sort of thing, the demotions, the technical foul rates, all this stuff, it's important information for teams. It's important information for fans. And I do think that we're shedding a light on this stuff because it is important. It decides games. Like we saw with the LeBron James botched call at the end of the game against the Celtics on national TV.
It would only happen to him, though. It's a one-off.
Like, the referees put out a tweet saying, like, this is going to cause many sleepless nights. Yes. And so it does have an effect, for sure.
Man, so there's a couple things here. One, if I'm Fred VanVleet, I think the way you guys framed it on your podcast is this is a person, if they were making $100,000, the fine being the equivalent of 100, to get your enemy demoted and for $100 like this publicly, wow, what a win for Fred VanVleet. Two, there is no, if there's one thing that the NBA officials get so wrong, it's the way that they try to present their brand. Do you remember the commercial they did? I always reference it. From a couple of years ago, where they would stop fans in the street or in a park and they would go, what do you think of this ref? And they would say, he's an idiot. And then all of a sudden, like, a ref would come out of the bushes and they'd say, I'm a ref and it hurts my feelings when you say that. And I was going, what the hell is this? Why would these guys think this is smart? Sleepless nights, all this stuff. They're really, really bad with the whole angle of kind of their hard done by. That being said, there is a small part of me that goes, you can't have this too hard on the officials because you need to incentivize them to be great. You need to incentivize them not to ever cheat or do something, nefarious, that which has actually happened in the past, but also that you keep the best officials there, that guys aren't retiring too early, that you're keeping veteran officials around, all this different stuff. Because one of the other things, watch college basketball this past weekend, friends. Like, it's so much worse. so bad in so many situations where you go, oh my God, I cannot believe that this actually just happened and that these kids are going to go home. Their college careers are over because this official is just beyond terrible. And so, striking this balance is always going to be hard for the leagues where you want that accountability. It needs to be more accountable with, these guys in the gambling era, but maybe they have to be paid more. I don't know what the solution is here.
Oh yeah, they are getting paid more, by the way. Yeah. Like they just agreed to a new labor agreement with the NBA where they're going to get big raises across the board. And you know, it matters a lot that an official gets promoted to the playoffs. You get bigger game checks in the playoffs. You get bonuses in the playoffs if you make it there. So like these referee ratings, internal referee ratings, are important. And it's not just about accountability internally, it's accountability publicly. Like, I don't think a lot of fans know how the referees work, like where they come from. They don't know much about them. And yet if you go on Twitter or social media, every night is just fans upset about the referees. And I just think that there does need to be more accountability in this. And the last 2 minute reports are nice. I think it's a nice nice just acknowledgement that they are doing some work behind the scenes to vet these referees and their calls every night. But why not the 48-minute report? Why not make all of those reports public? And that is, you know, something that NBA teams want is, hey, if you call a foul on OG Anunoby to make his third foul in the 6th minute of the game, that has way more impact on the outcome of the game than just like a random call with 3 minutes left of a close game. Like putting OG Anunoby on the bench, like that's big. There are huge pivotal calls made throughout the 48-minute game. And so I think there's going to be more accountability going forward. And, you know, referees, like I do feel bad for them in terms of the scrutiny that they get, the criticism they get. Not a lot of human beings can have the thick skin to referee and hear that on a constant basis when you're out there on a basketball court in front of 20,000 fans. However, they get paid very nicely. Let's not ignore that. And also, like, they get to travel around the country. They get to mingle with LeBron James and Steph Curry and Fred VanVleet. Like, this is, in terms of cocktail party jobs, being an NBA referee, there is some value in that. You are going to be one of the most interesting conversations at any cocktail party because you get to basically be face-to-face on a first-name basis with celebrities. And that may not be everything, but let's not act that this is, you know, they're wartime nurses in the trenches, that this is the hardest job in the world.
No, that's what I'm saying about the way that they market themselves with this, because they do act like that with the whole sleepless nights thing, and you go, okay, just maybe ignore it. I have some theories about this, though, and this is why I've actually been a little bit more pro-ref lately, is simply I think that, one, the social media stuff is, it's harder than ever to be critical of players in earnest, and I think that a lot of fan bases, too, they want to stay out of it because you criticize a player, and I'm not saying it doesn't happen, obviously it does. You can search any NBA player's name and it's, you know, a cesspool. It's awful out there. But generally, among sports fans, ones that have like a little bit of a following, whatever, the lean now is to go more positive with the team. And the officials are sort of the last place on Twitter where everyone can throw all their vitriol and there's essentially no consequence. People will agree with you. It's a way to get likes, retweets, whatever. It's not your fault. It's the ref's fault. They get the blanket omission. We do have gambling, which I think heightens that frustration amongst people. There's definitely a lot of people out there placing wagers and a lot of people that care about this stuff. The calls that get made wrong, they do get so public and they are so big. And these stars have so much weight when LeBron does say stuff like that. It becomes, you know, a 24-hour, 48-hour news cycle. I actually think if I'm an official, I want the thing you're talking about, the 48-minute report. Because if you look at baseball, for example, right? I think the umpires on average miss 13 calls a game is what I had it written down somewhere. I lost it. I heard that on the 99% Invisible podcast, which is excellent, by the way. I'm listening to that. I write that down. And you look at umpire scorecards, and they get most of the calls correct. And I actually don't mind a little bit of human error in my sports. I don't really advocate. I think the stuff we've seen with robot officials and sky cams, sky judges, all this different stuff, it shows that it's flawed as well. But to me, it's actually made umpires more, I don't know, I'm more respectful of them now, knowing the amount of good calls they get. And I feel like in the NBA, this would come out well for them. Like, how do you think this would actually go? Why wouldn't they want that out there if it turns out that refs make, what, let's say 90% of the correct calls, how that would go over with an audience?
Well, so a couple things on here. And by the way, you are very on top of this topic. Like, usually when
Toronto,
I go on...
Man, it's like, have you ever watched a Raptors game before, Tom? Have you seen Nick Nurse? The entire game is him bitching at the officials, tomato face red. All of his players bitching about the refs. Fred VanVleet went up there and it was fine. And then the entire fan base constantly is doing this. Our broadcasts are constantly talking about it the entire time. Like, we are, I was actually going to ask you this question. If, you know, we're doing league pass ratings of teams that complain the most about the officials, top to bottom, from like coach to fans. It has to be us. We have to be number one. Give us this, Tom.
You're up there for sure.
Yeah.
And the Dallas Mavericks for sure are up there too with Luka and Mark Cuban. I mean, that combination is
as
powerhouse
Cuban.
From this standpoint.
Cuban's
like,
such
Jason
a huge
Kidd
ace in the
might
hole.
Not. Yeah. Yeah. That's the number one pick if you want to go for complainers about the referees.
Oh yeah.
I think he's had over $1 million in fines from the league office because of his complaints about officials. But I think what you're getting at is you don't want the referees to be an excuse for actual analysis on the team. Like, you 100%. Don't want to just be like, Hey, we lost this game because of this terrible call, when in actuality, like, maybe it was you guys didn't hit threes, or that you you weren't playing any defense, and you don't want this. It's a tendency for an athlete, tendency for fans to just not want to look at your own mistakes and blame it on someone else. I'm not saying that referees are perfect, but what you're describing in baseball is interesting because Hawkeye is this new technology that the NBA is implementing where they're going to have basically VAR, automated calls coming in from the broadcast and basically assessing whether referees got those calls right or wrong and not having to go to those endless referee reviews for like 10 minutes at a time and to see every angle, 17 different angles, and then have them rule whether it was a overturned or the call stands. Like they are going to, the NBA starting next season is going to have Hawkeye cameras that you see in World Cup, that you see in tennis, basically ruling whether the call was right or a 3-2, a goaltending, 5-second calls. They're going to start automating these things. And that's what's going to be interesting is the NBA assesses their own calls here. Like right now, the NBA grades their own referees. So imagine in school if the students got to grade their own papers or students got to grade their own exams. The trust level isn't high amongst teams right now. Is like, yeah, the NBA says that they get 95% of their calls right, but you know who's doing that assessment? It's the NBA.
Yeah.
And so to use technology where, like, in baseball, those calls are being, the umpire calls, balls and strikes, are automated, that it is robots basically assessing how far it was off the plate. And that's more objective than what we have in the league right now. The NBA is assessing and grading their own calls. And you can understand that, like, you would have an incentive as an NBA league office that hires and trains these officials to say, hey, we're at 95% correct. That's how good we are at this officiating thing. And to me, if I'm a fan, I'm like, all right, well, aren't you the one grading those exams? And so I think that is an interesting dynamic here is as technology starts to take over these officiating calls, we might see either that number come down from 95% or maybe it is 95% accurate based on that Hawkeye AI technology.
It'll probably come down. But again, to use baseball as a point of reference, when baseballs first put in their technology for calling balls and strikes, and I've mentioned this before, but they actually had to make adjustments so that the robots were calling things that were slightly off the plate. Because what ended up happening, they called this perfect strike zone that had no wiggle room for anything. And the players, the league, everybody essentially ended up agreeing that it didn't feel right. They went, this doesn't feel right the way that this is calling it. They had to make adjustments to expand the strike zone to places where, again, the robot would have to assess a little bit off the plate was still a strike. And so I hope what we don't lose a little bit here is that, yes, our officials going to be perfect. Of course, they're never going to be perfect, but neither will the machines. There is a feel to a game that an official is going to be able to have that a machine is not going to be able to. So we should use it, I think, a lot of times like data sets where you get, hey, this is helpful for some information. This should be used in terms of guiding what officials are doing and giving fans, again, more accountability. But these things just, yeah, I worry that people look at them and say they're going to be perfect systems and that when they have this information, they go, see, look, this is proof positive that these officials are getting something wrong. So, yeah, a little bit scary right. for the officials, I would say. Like, that's...
Well, I think what you're saying here is totally true, which is sometimes you don't want it automated because if the referees called every foul on every play or every travel on every play...
Yeah.
It would be endless. It'd be a horrible product. In the same way that if a robot umpire in baseball, there were no strikes, it was a tight strike zone and everyone was walking and no one was swinging the bat, that's a horrible product too. So yeah, there is, as much as we'd like to think that robots are objective, there is some subjectivity in how they're assessing their system. So that, if you have a... So one great example is Giannis Antetokounmpo at the free throw line. Okay, we covered this at Levitard, which is in the postseason a couple years ago. Giannis Antetokounmpo, the referees were not calling 10-second violations on Giannis at the free throw line. And it was going to like 13 seconds, 14 seconds. And
famously
the
counting.
Human, yep, famously counted is a huge story. And yet the referees would not call that violation. And so he was getting an advantage at the free throw line, which other teams are like, what the heck? Like, if you're not enforcing the rule, then there is no rule. It's a toothless rule. An automated referee, the Hawkeye technology, as soon as that clock hits 10 seconds, you call a violation and it's over. If the 5-second call, an inbounds pass, as soon as it hits 5 seconds, it is a violation. In human refereeing, Don Vaden was telling us during when we were covering that story about Giannis getting, 11 seconds at the free throw line, he was saying that as a referee, on those 5-second violations, they tend to wait an extra beat or two, like 6 seconds, 7 seconds, mm-hmm. so that basically when they review the call after the game, you got this cushion. You're like, I waited so that I wouldn't do it too early. So I waited to 6 seconds, or I counted to 7 seconds before I blew my whistle so that I wasn't, counting too fast. And so I do think that there is some wiggle room between what we want as fans to be accurate and correct and what is a good product. And I think if we were, if we were calling every defensive 3 seconds, Nick Nurse is really good at that, by the way, planting guys in the paint and basically daring the officials to call defensive 3 seconds. Kyle Lowry famously did it a while back. And then, when you have 5 switchable guys, that's a defense you like to do, is just basically camping out in the paint so that you can wall off the paint without having a huge big man out there. That's the sort of stuff that if we automated calls in the NBA with robots, maybe they would have to kind of like recalibrate it and say like, okay, if it's a 90 percentile foul, let's call it. But if it's like a borderline 50-50 foul, let's lower that dial on the robot and say like, okay, 50-50 calls, let's just let it play. But maybe it's 70%. Maybe that's the sweet spot. And I just think that's really interesting is the question going forward is like, when they automate these referee calls, there is going to be some subjectivity based on the product on the field.
Yes, 100%. Finally, we actually have a more useful use for the G League is do this. Test out the G League, use them as the guinea pigs. Yeah, maybe that's why it's the G League now. It's guinea pig league. And they just do that and find out how to help make the robots halfway decent. Okay, so I have one Raptors question for you before we go, and thanks for being so generous with the time. OG Anunoby took to the podium yesterday, and he was talking about how he wants to be Defensive Player of the Year. He's thought he's been that for quite some time, blah, 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 blah. He's great defensively. And for me personally, and probably some bias built into this, I'm watching the Raptors against the Bucks the other night and watch a decent amount of Bucks. Sure, Brook Lopez had a terrific season, and there are all these analytics to support him being Defensive Player of the Year, and a lot of them are just like shot alteration statistics, right? But I'm watching Brook Lopez and I'm saying there is absolutely no way in hell I would choose Brook Lopez if I needed a stop on a team over OG Anunoby. Like, I'm watching OG play Nikola Jokic to like a really effective degree, and he can do that against Donovan Mitchell the very next night, right? Go out to the perimeter. And I'm curious when, like, for somebody like you who is so embedded in the numbers, if we've just gotten to a place where it's really, really hard to put perimeter players out there because statistically it's way easier to have big men, or the big men just pop more. This has sort of been like the Rudy Gobert thing year over year over year, where his numbers analytically are insanely good, and it's hard to make a case for anybody else against him unless you do go with the eye test a bit more. And so, yeah, when we're talking about best defensive player of the year, does it really go against guys like OG who defend more perimeter players rather than guys who are working inside defending the rim?
Yeah, so I think this is one of those like civil wars of debate, is like, should we have perimeter players in today's day and age, switchability, ability to guard the perimeter and the paint, get out to the three-point line, because this is a three-point era. If you have a guy who can get out there and close out and basically eliminate the three-pointer, isn't that more valuable than protecting the paint? I still think that OG Anunoby, regardless, in any era, he is an all-defensive player. He is an amazing defensive player, instincts, length, strength, his ability to talk out on the floor. Like, he is a communicator that I think people, when you want a defensive player, you want someone who's not just got all the tools. It's someone like Draymond Green who calls out the opposing offense and basically orchestrating a defense. And OG Anunoby right now, my favorite metric, all-in-one metric, there's a ton of them, but my favorite one is estimated plus-minus, which is on Dunks and Threes, one of the best sites out there for analytics, NBA analytics. And right now, if you look at who are the best defensive players, you're going to find that Brook Lopez is not that guy. He's not rating very well defensively by that metric. However, OG Anunoby is a guy who's third in the NBA on a per-minute basis behind Jaren Jackson Jr. and Alex Caruso. Alex Caruso being a perimeter player, but doesn't play nearly the same number of minutes that OG Anunoby does. So of the 30-minute players, 30 minutes a night, OG Anunoby is the best defensive player by the estimated plus-minus system. And I think a lot of what you're seeing with OG Anunoby is, man, you can plug him into any defense, any team, and he's going to be elite defensively. He's got the tools, the size, the strength, all of that, the legs. And you have Brook Lopez actually way down on that list, because part of that metric is incorporating your teammates. And when you see Brook Lopez, it's a plus 1.9 defensive rating in this system, and OG Anunoby is plus 3.4. So 3.4 for OG and 1.9 for Brook Lopez. Brook Lopez has the benefit of playing next to Giannis, who's a Defensive Player of the Year candidate every year. Jrue Holiday, Defensive Player of the Year candidate every year. And so it's hard to kind of parse what is Brook Lopez and what is Giannis and what is Jrue Holiday and what is Grayson Allen. They have a lot of plus defenders on that team, and I think OG stands apart from the perimeter standpoint. And I think in today's era with three-point shooting, that has to count for something. And so we'll see how this goes. But to me, OG Anunoby has just as good of a case, if not better, as Brook Lopez.
Yeah. I think sometimes it feels right to give a guy the Defensive Player of the Year award when he's on a really great defensive team. It's almost like the acknowledgement of, hey, you guys won this award together. The Celtics got that a little bit last year with Smart, right? There are other years where I feel like, no, this can't be the one. I don't think Brook Lopez is the second best defensive player on his team. And I think he's the third, which is great. That's a really, really good thing to be. But to win that award based on, yeah, I think some numbers that are more team affected versus a guy like OG, you can make the case that like maybe he deserves it less because the Raptors have been so disappointing defensively this year. But for me, when I hear that statistic, I go, damn, OG's numbers are that, given the context of the guys he's played around this year have been, yeah, really, really below average. And yes, absolutely, I will take the 6'7" wing defender who's 25 years old and able to do it all versus the guy who's my age in Brook Lopez and, yeah, kind of is a little bit more one-dimensional defensively. That's all. And, Tom, I think you just, you know, you basically promised your vote to Toronto. You got a vote, right? Like, you just promised it. So, yeah.
Well, I think when you look at the rest of the Raptors defensively, like, I do think if you put OG Anunoby on that Bucks team, they go from like third in the defensive rating to like by far the number one, the best defense. So like if you had Brook Lopez behind Fred VanVleet, behind Gary Trent Jr., behind Will Barton, that's going to be tough. That's going to be tough. He's not going to look as good. But you know what? Like, it's tough in today's era where in order to lift up a candidate, we almost have to put down another candidate. And I think Brook Lopez and Jrue Holiday and Giannis are excellent defenders. It's just OG Anunoby brings something that they don't, in that his size and his speed and all of that is different than Jrue Holiday, Giannis, and Brook. And he happens to be on a team that's middle of the pack defensively. And like you said, I thought last year Robert Williams had a much better case than Marcus Smart, but Marcus Smart got it because he's the star defender on the best defense in the NBA. So he got best defender, best team, best defense in the NBA award, which to me I think limits the pool and it kind of minimizes the analysis to just like looking at the standings.
Yeah, and me as a Gary Payton fan got completely screwed over because now my coolest Gary Payton stat is done. The only point guard to ever win Defensive Player of the Year. Now he has to share that with Marcus Smart, who sucks this year. Anyway, Tom Haberstroh, always appreciate the time. Again, Basketball Illuminati, Underdogs Podcast, Count the Dings. It's all great. Thank you so much for the time today, man.
You got it.
Take care. There he goes, Tom Haberstroh. Quick break. Let's come back and give you my best bet.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Right, Austin. Yesterday's bet hit, and it was the Colorado Avalanche to score first and win. And so I think that's why he played this, or it was just a complete fluke incident. Oh, it's fluke. Was it a fluke?
No, it was completely on purpose.
All right.
There's no hesitation there.
Austin is dialed in today.
had a ton of time to think about it there.
That's right. Best Bets brought to you by Betano, the 2022 Global Sports Betting Operator of the Year. That's pretty good. That's a pretty good award to win.
It's a pretty good title.
It is a damn good book. I'm telling you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
253 offerings tonight on the Leafs.
Thank you. You know I love that stat.
Yep.
And guess where I'm going tonight?
That's a JD stat.
I'm going to that game. This one is just going to be plain and simple, easy, freaking peasy. All right? I'm not even going into the 253 offerings that it has for this game tonight. Well, I probably will.
Yeah.
But
not right now.
Not for this pick.
Right.
Not for this pick. I just think it's good value for the Leafs. Mm-hmm. Islanders have been a little hot lately. They're making a playoff push. And I think our dumb brains do this a lot where we go, well, Islanders need it more and they're at home. And Pierre Engvall is playing in his revenge game. There's going to be money on the board for old Pierre. Guess what? I don't think so. I think that John Tavares still cares way more about returning to play the Islanders than the Islanders care about their new enigmatic teammate, Pierre Engvall. As many points as he might be racking up in the top six with them right now. Yeah, if Pierre Engvall's in your top six, I'm betting against you. All right? I will say that, actually, I should pull this up. Betano definitely has a Pierre Engvall goal, right?
Yeah.
Find it for me while I do the rest of my rant, because I can't scroll and look for that as I... Because it might be decent to put at least down a dollar or two on a Pierre Engvall point.
Every former Leaf scores against the Leafs.
Well, that's just... not only that, it's just, you know, nerd Twitter, like my boy Ian Tullett coming up here in a second, needs to freak out about Pierre Engvall.
Plus 345 for Pierre Engvall, anytime goal.
Little sprinkle on that for sure. But anyway, my best bet is just the Leafs. They're minus 122 on Betano.
Mm-hmm.
They're the better team, and it's John Tavares. And here's the little cherry on top. Islanders are coming back from the West Coast, and they're playing their first home game. That is a big-time letdown spot in this league. They just beat up on the old Anaheim Ducks. They're feeling good about themselves.
San Jose Sharks.
San Jose Sharks. They got those points. They collected them. They lost to the Kings, and now they're heading back home. Mm-hmm. Teams usually stink when they get back from the West Coast road trip. We all know the first home game back, letdown spot. Leafs, minus 122. Better team. Those situations. John Tavares facing his former team. Don't overthink it. That is my Betano best bet of the day. That was brought to you by Betano, in case you couldn't tell. The game starts now. Quick break. Let's come back. Let's talk to my nerdy friend, Ian Tullock. People say I'm not a numbers guy. Those people are idiots. Because today I had Tom Haberstroh, and now I have the man with Graf and his Twitter handle, Ian Tullock, at Ian Graf. Doesn't tweet anymore. He's too good for tweeting. I guess won't even share the show when it's done. And if he doesn't, he'll never appear on this program again. What's up, buddy? Data analyst, hockey data analyst. What's up, pal? How are we doing?
Yeah, I'm lurking in the shadows. Sorry for not tweeting. I know how much everyone appreciates my Pierre Engvall grass.
I actually did like your tweets. You were good on Twitter. I don't know why you decided. I know that you lurk in the shadows and you have all these shadowy jobs behind the scenes that you need to keep in secret. And so you don't want to be out there in the Twitter streets. But yeah, I would welcome you back. But yeah, you're right. You can save the Pierre Engvall graphs. We get it. We really do. So if you had some graphs for Timothy Liljegren right now, what would they be saying? Because the eye test is really showing me a guy that at one point this year looked like one of the Leafs' best defensemen. And lately I'm looking at him thinking, damn, could he be back on the playoff roster bubble?
So when we talked earlier in the year, we were talking about how incredible his goals against rates were. And that's something that over the last 3 to 5 years has been one of the most predictive stats defensively. I know in hockey, we can predict offense really well. Point production for forwards, even just goal rates for forwards. That does a good job of predicting offense. But defense is something we've always had a tough part measuring, sussing out the actual defensive environment from goaltending, which is completely random. But goals against has actually been a decent way of measuring it. And throughout most of the season, Liljegren was among the best, not just in the Leafs, but in the league when it came to preventing goals against. He's had a bit of a rough stretch lately, not just the last 10 games. Even if you go 20 or 30 games, it's definitely been on the downslope. I'd hate to see someone like Luke Shen take a playoff spot away from Timothy Liljegren, because I still believe in the player. I think not just the puck moving and the offensive instincts, but I really like the way he defends the rush. I think with his mobility and his ability to to corner a player and angle them off towards the boards and force them to dump the puck in instead of coming down off the rush and creating some kind of dangerous chance. I still think he has the ability, and I think that eventually we're going to see some regression to where he ends up playing much better, and the goals against are going to be looking much, much lower on the stat sheet. But it hasn't been great for him lately. I'm not sure if there's an ideal partner for him, because it seems like Jake McCabe, they really want to play against tough competition. So I'd imagine we see a McCabe-Brody pairing, or maybe a McCabe-Hall pairing. That leaves you Liljegren probably in some more sheltered minutes, maybe with a Mark Giordano. So we're probably not getting the 20-plus minutes we were talking about earlier in the year that we thought Liljegren might be ready for. But I still firmly believe in him as a player. I think over the last couple of years, he's had some of the best ice-tilting numbers in hockey, even if you adjust for competition. So it hasn't been great lately, but I believe in the player, and I believe in the large sample. I think things will turn around soon.
Yeah, I like him too, and that's pretty surprising given where I was with him at the very beginning of his career and what I thought that he would turn out to be. I agree with you. The larger sample has shown someone that's made big strides, big progress, and part of me even wonders when I'm watching him play if I'm projecting a little bit, the idea of you want to have more playoff-style defensemen like the Luke Shens of the world. I also think in the small viewings that we've gotten of Gustafsson lately that he's actually looked better than I anticipated him being with this team. There's just a confidence that he's played with recently that I've really liked. With Liljegren, seems like, yeah, he's had some, he's just not showing some of the same stuff that he did before. I think that the physicality is gone, and maybe it's, again, I'm measuring it against other guys. But you're saying, like, the numbers are backing it up, and they have been for quite some time. I wonder if you think that this is more of an issue of who he's being paired with, or if this could potentially just be, yeah, a younger guy who tried to really ramp up his physical play this season, the minutes that he played this season, the role he played this season, and frankly just could be wearing down at the wrong time.
And we see this with older players all the time. I mean, Ron Hainsey back in the day, even you could argue Mark Giordano, where earlier in the year he looked a bit more effective, and because he's playing every single game towards the end of the season, he's slowing down a little bit.
Yeah, it was nice to give him a rest day.
Yeah, finally, right? Yeah. But it's with goals against, that's the hard part, is they're very noisy, right? So you could go through a 10-game stretch where all of a sudden your goals against spike, and it's not really your fault. It's just some bad bounces not going your way. But you can look at other metrics like shots, expected goals, scoring chances, and they're not as dominant now as they were earlier in the year. I know he did really well with Sandin on a sheltered pairing, but for me it was really seeing him play with someone like Mark Giordano on a second pairing, or seeing him play with Morgan Riley in a short stretch, where if you look at Morgan Riley's partners throughout the season, Timothy Liljegren's the partner he's had the most success with when it comes to goals against and scoring chances against. Now, granted, maybe they're being put out in some advantageous situations after an icing in the offensive zone against a tired group, but I still think there's a little bit something there, and I know that they're playing around with different pairing ideas. I'd like to see them give Riley Liljegren a bit more rope, because I think that's something that might actually work. Liljegren's sneaky good at defending the rush.
Yeah, the only thing is that there's, I would say that the most, again, this is an eye test thing, but some of the most jarring Leafs defensive play moments are when those two guys are together and the puck gets in deep, and then they have to defend the front of the net together, and it can be pretty tough to watch at times. And that is where you start thinking about stuff like a playoff matchup and guys getting to those dirty areas and guys having to be moved from those dirty areas. And I go, it makes me just a little bit uncomfortable. I think that it was our friend Anthony Petrelli that pointed out that, hey, listen, the 11-7 thing is actually a little bit overstated when it comes to the way the Lightning have used it in the playoffs. I wrote it down somewhere because I went back and I actually looked at the numbers, and I don't have it in front of me, but I want to say it was 11 out of maybe 48 playoff games that they decided to go 11-7. But there are moments where I go, maybe this actually is a way forward for them at some junction. At some point come playoff time, there is some way to work this. Because, yeah, to me, there just doesn't seem to be perfect pairings. Like, there's always the, well, put this person with Brody and that works. But, yeah, you can't put him with every single person. And so I'm just not sure how they operate that. Are there particular pairings that you like outside of the idea of Liljegren with Riley more often? And this can extend to the forward group when it comes to lines, because they've done a lot of shuffling there too.
Yeah, so on the D pairings, you brought up a good point that Brody plays well with anyone. Brody can fix Justin Hall. Brody can play with McCabe against tough competition. Brody can be the safety blanket for Morgan Riley that lets him pinch a lot. So you can really play him anywhere. I'm not sure if I have perfect D pairings for you. I wish I did. We don't have a huge sample on Jake McCabe yet. I know that in the small sample of seeing him, I don't want to say it's his fault for the underwhelming numbers. We'll get to it. The team as a whole in the month of March has been playing, I think, their worst hockey of the season. I know they've been sneaking out a few wins, but we'll get to some of the numbers behind why they aren't performing so well. But yeah, I wish I had a great answer for you here, but I don't know if I have perfect D pairings. I think that's why they're playing around with them a lot right now, because they themselves don't feel super confident in three set pairings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely agree. Let's get into the stuff that you're talking about, though, because I would say that most people have been really, really happy with the start of Jake McCabe's Leafs career, but his numbers are not indicating such.
Well, it's not they're not bad relative to the team. It's just the entire team is underwater right now. We looked at the Leafs earlier in the league, they were among the leaders in shot differential, scoring chance differential. But if we look over the last month, Jake McCabe and Sam Lafferty were traded on February 27th. So if we look since March 1st, the Leafs are worse than the Chicago Blackhawks and Arizona Coyotes in expected goal differential or scoring chance differential at 5-on-5. They're one of the worst teams in the league in shot differential at 5-on-5. That's not where you want to be. And I know that it's just a 10-game sample, but at some point these things start to matter, and this is a bit of their roster construction. I know you could say that Ryan O'Reilly's been out of the lineup, so that naturally affects things, but Ryan O'Reilly wasn't on their roster when they were playing some of their best hockey of the year earlier in the year when Riley was out of the lineup. And there's about a 15-game sample there where they were the league leader in scoring chance differential and shot differential. So I don't want to blame all of this on Ryan O'Reilly not playing well. Yeah. I think the forward line combinations, I think there's something to be said there. We could talk about the bottom six, which has been kind of struggling lately ever since the trades that they'd been making with Engvall going out and Lafferty coming in. I've got a few thoughts on David Camp, because whenever David Camp played with Pierre Engvall, they dominated shots and scoring chances. Every time he plays without Engvall, he's getting filled in defensively. And I'm kind of worried that without a puck transporter, that David Camp, Noel Achari, Zach Aston-Reese line, it reminds me a bit of the Zach Aston-Reese, Camp, and who's the guy that they waived earlier in the year? He's a defensive specialist, and I'm forgetting his name. Obey Kubel. Yeah. They had three defensive specialists on the line.
They
thought it would work.
I thought you were going to say Dryden Hunt, and I was like, I don't remember that.
No, this is way earlier in the year. Yeah. But they had three defensive specialists on a line, and that line got killed at even strength, and they had to waive Obey Kubel. So I think you do need some puck transporting there. It doesn't necessarily need to be a Pierre Engvall, but I think it needs to be someone, because when they try to put these three defensive specialists on a line together, no one's able to get the puck up the ice into the offensive zone. It's just strong defending.
So I would say a couple things. You mentioned it. It is a smaller sample than what we have from the rest of the year, but sure, 10 games is, I would say, at least enough where we can look at it and start to notice some trends. The first thing that comes to mind is that they've played that horrible Senators game in there, that awful, basically, second period onward against the Sabres, which would really tilt it, and then a very, very tough game against the Avalanche where they just really got their asses handed to them in that Avalanche game. Colorado just essentially gave them nothing, and so I'm guessing analytically, those three games, just off the top of my head, really, really pop or would stand out when it comes to, their bad numbers or putting them in a category with some of the worst teams in the league. But I think this is sort of part of the gamble that they made as a team, right, is they were going to regress analytically with some of the guys that they moved out or some of the players that they brought in, that their gamble is, hey, when it comes to the playoffs, you're going to notice that the style of hockey changes and we feel better prepared for that kind of style of play. And if it doesn't work, it is going to be very interesting to see the way that people respond to it, because, a lot of the stuff that I think a large hockey community embraced Kyle Dubas and the Maple Leafs over, we'll see if they end up turning and looking at this and saying, well, what the hell? You had this team. It was very, very good. You had all these analytically sound players. You had this incredible shot differential, all these different things, and it regressed, and then it didn't work out for you come playoff time. Maybe then you don't have a vision. Maybe then you are kind of lost. So it is still pretty big. So, you mentioned Camp in the bottom six. I wonder, is there any number that you love? Like, is there a number that's actually popping for you from a positive standpoint right now? Because, it does sound like a lot of negative from an analytical standpoint the last 10 games for the Leafs.
All right, let's go positive here. Cal Yarncroc, not just the goals, not just the fact that he's playing with Matthews and Marner now, but really, as long as he's not playing with Camp, as long as he's playing with some kind of skill, whether it's Kerfoot, whether it's Tavares and Nylander on the second line, or even a third line with Kerfoot there, the numbers are very positive. And it's not just shot differential. It's actual goals. He's converting at an elite rate. He's scoring at, I want to say, at a career high rate for him. He's going to go north of 20 goals this year and north of 45 points he's on pace for. So that's what you were paying for. I was really skeptical of that contract when I saw it. I didn't know if he was a type of player that was worth 4 years of turn, but year one is going really well for him right now. I like what I'm seeing. I think come playoff time, he'll be that depth scoring that they're actually looking for on a third line.
Yeah, it's funny because he looks really good with the top six guys, and part of my brain goes, aren't you supposed to when you're playing with the best players on the planet? Like, isn't that supposed to be? Shouldn't your numbers be pretty damn good if you play with the guy who won the Hart Trophy last year? I'd say yeah. Shouldn't they be pretty good if you're playing with Mitch Marner and John Tavares and, yeah, and William Nylander, who's having a career season? I would say yes. I've actually been sort of underwhelmed by him when he is in the bottom six, which is my only kind of concern with him. Maybe it ends up being a good thing because they really don't have that other left winger that is, should be guaranteed a spot in the top six. Maybe he ends up getting that. I thought that the quote from Keith the other day was pretty interesting on him, where he was saying Matthews felt pretty strongly about continuing with Yarncroc for the rest of the game. So, yeah, let's take a peek at it. I think it is good. But this does tie into, and finally, we'll get to your boy Engvall here, which is we don't need to relitigate whether or not he's good. I think it's pretty clear that you're never going to change my mind on Pierre Engvall. I was joking with a buddy. He could win the Conn Smythe, and I would say it was fine. But my only thing with Engvall is that, yeah, they got a third-round pick back. They didn't get anything that was, wow, you have to do that trade. Like with Sandin getting a first, I was, wow, I can't believe they acquired that back, especially considering they did add to their blue line. And I don't think Gustavsson right now, where those two guys are at in their career, that the Leafs took some kind of step backwards, a big step backwards. I think that they made pretty much a lateral move while also acquiring a first-round pick. That was a good deal for them. The Engvall one was a little interesting because they didn't really get a lot back, and they lost some of their forward depth. And I said, okay, they brought a lot of guys in, and you can't have too many dudes. But now they've suffered some injuries, and we always talk about this with the blue line pretty much exclusively when it comes to playoffs. We say, oh, injuries on the blue line. You got to have depth in your blue line. And I go, yeah, for a team that struggled with secondary scoring, I would say that it's also important for them to have forwards, that's important, that, hey, I like the way Bobby McMahon looks, just like the rest of us, but if he's in a playoff series or Wayne Simmonds has to draw in, I'm not going to be overly thrilled about that idea. Do we have to wait to see Nyes and what he can do before this is determined? But, yeah, did the Leafs make a mistake not keeping him just when it came to forward depth?
Or let's say for fun that they traded Engvall away and then brought in another forward of similar value.
It'd be surely much better.
Yeah, exactly. And for everyone who hates Engvall, I think they'd still be willing to admit that he's roughly a third-line player, but his style of play maybe doesn't lend itself to winning in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Getting to the inside,
you
not finishing
it.
His checks in the forecheck. I see what you see. I'm watching these games. I get it. I totally get it. I try to step back and look at things in the aggregate, and anytime a guy consistently tilts the ice, I try to say, let's strip away my bias, let's strip away all these things that I think I know about the game, and this guy is driving results. But then in the playoffs, if he's not driving results to the same degree, do I tell myself that's a small sample, or do I tell myself, no, the game has significantly changed and a different style of play will actually help you perform better, whereas someone like Engvall, who's, I don't know how you'd want to describe him, but he's a puck transporter who more or less stays to the outside in the offensive zone and doesn't want to get into the corners or the front of the net. Maybe you want a guy more like Sam Lafferty in that situation, but from what I've seen so far, Sam Lafferty is not driving results at the NHL level, and his shooting percentage was double what his career average was this season, so I'm not sure if I trust that to last.
So we'll get back to the question. You kind of turned that into Engvall propaganda. All I'm saying is, yeah, is it too early to tell whether or not they did kind of blow that? Because when you're talking about a puck transporter or somebody that can come in and hopefully help out a guy like Kampf, I think at this point it's pretty clear if you have hope for Matthew Nyes, it's that he's in a bottom six role and that he's the guy that ends up taking that slot.
I'd see him more in a line with, I'd go Nyes, Kerfoot, Yarncroc, get
sure.
A more offensively oriented third line there. I feel like anytime you play an offensively skilled player with David Kampf, it's a waste of their skill set because Kampf is a defensive specialist and you're not going to generate too many chances with him on the ice. So
yeah.
I do think that there's a chance that Matthew Nyes comes into this lineup, slots into that third line role, and it clicks offensively because Yarncroc's rolling. Kerfoot's a pretty good passer off the rush. And Nyes projects to be a good power forward in the tough areas. In theory, that line should work, but it's very tough for players of Nye's age coming into the NHL and making an impact immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But to say it's too early, I don't know, 10 to 15 games, there's a bit of noise, but there's also a lot of signal there. And frankly, I don't like what I'm seeing from the Leafs' bottom six right now. Their top six hasn't played as well as they have previously this season. I think guys like Nylander need to step it up. I think Matthews could play a little bit better. But overall, I don't think it's a great sign over the last month. I think we're looking at the wins and losses and saying that they're squeaking out some wins. But, you know, analytically, I'm always going to look at my Corsi and my scoring chances and all those, and they've been really bad this month. So I feel like I need to acknowledge that.
Yeah, and that's the reason why I wanted to have you on today. I think that it's important to paint in the backdrop. People would look at it, and I have, and saying, hey, this is good that the Leafs are finding ways to win these games, and that is important. They've gotten some decent goaltending at times, not so much in the Matt Murray situation. But, yeah, I would say that they are going to be built differently when it comes to how they're going to try to win, and that judging them on this, especially having this body of information and saying, hey, you were this team, and then you were this team, and this team indicated that you were much worse and that the things that you were trying to accomplish, it made it harder for you, and you based them on intangibles, that's going to be hard to justify to a lot of different people if the Leafs end up flaming out and if they go against the grain. I still stand by, I think, their decision. I do think that it is going to make for a better team come playoffs, one that is better suited to go deeper into the postseason if they are able to get over the Tampa hurdle. And Boston got it so daunting for them that it's going to be difficult either way. But, yeah, I think that it's important. I think it's a really important contextual backdrop. Ian, it's always, our audience is always smarter when you come on. So I appreciate you doing this, buddy.
Hey, thanks. I know it's a bit pessimistic right now. I'm hoping that in April or May, we have some really positive numbers to talk about. Sorry. Sometimes you're dealing in facts, not always positive.
You're supposed to be the numbers guy, okay? This is supposed to be without feeling. Positive and negative is not a thing in your realm. It's just supposed to be, what does the data say, all right? Let me worry about the barbs for the positive, negative, whatever, that all crap. The toxic positivity and the toxic negativity. Ian Tulloch, hockey data analyst, one of my favorites. Thanks for doing this, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Sounds good, man. Take care.
Pal. I will say that they certainly, to me, don't look like a team that is in the bottom of the league. That's pretty clear. And they do have still the top-end skill, the top-end finishing. Mm-hmm. But I would say that two things that he said kind of translate for me. One is that, and a lot of this does have to do with Ryan O'Reilly not being there. He was the signature piece, so he can say the stuff about him not being here and blah, 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 and the team was really good before he got there. Yes, of course. But he was the signature piece that they brought in.
Yes.
He and McCabe, they were the top two guys.
Yeah.
So judging it on not having him down in the bottom six right now, especially, I think is really hard because he is supposed to be the guy that does balance things out, could give them so much more. They're missing him. Mm-hmm. They've now missed Achari for a game. They've been doing the 11-7 thing because they haven't had a ton of depth. They've just, frankly, the team has been weird these last 10 games.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of weirdness to them.
A lot of tinkering.
Yeah, a lot of tinkering. And so, to me, the eye test is not matched up with a team where they look brutal. They've had some brutal nights and some really bad periods.
Yes.
Back-to-back against Ottawa.
Yeah.
That probably really hurts you from an analytical standpoint in terms of the noise of these stats, right?
Yep.
You get 52 shots against, I think they only finished in the 20s, the Leafs. That's going to be a tough one for you.
Yeah, there was that game against Vancouver, too, earlier in the
Vancouver,
month.
Vancouver, tough game.
Yep.
Yep. They've had some bad ones. They've had some real stinkers. But even when I look at them, I don't feel as though the bottom six has looked phenomenal. I'm in agreement there.
Yep.
I think that Nola Chari, when he's been playing, has looked really, really awesome.
Yep.
Lafferty's speed has really popped at times, and he's created a couple of plays. But he hasn't been... I don't think he was supposed to be. But he hasn't been some guy that I've gone, wow, damn, the bottom six looks remarkable.
Yeah.
And this looks completely balanced. That said, they just do look like a better playoff bottom six. The big one to me is still the blue line, where if the solution to me is try Liljegren with Riley, I'm not overly thrilled about that idea. I actually like the Giordano pairing with Liljegren in a little bit more of a sheltered, hey, this is, but then you're in a situation where it's either Justin Hall or Luke Shen playing heavier minutes with somebody. I think that's what I would, if I was doing ideal pairings right now for the playoffs, it'd be Riley and Brody.
Okay.
McCabe and Hall.
Yep.
Giordano, Liljegren. And I'd be going for the balance within the group. And then I'd have Luke Shen as my seventh defenseman ready to step in if something's not working or they want to give it a bit of a different look. And he's probably either... I think he's probably coming in for Liljegren at this point. I know that's not a popular opinion, especially on social media, and especially given that, yeah, it's pretty clear that when Liljegren's been at his best, he's played much better than Hall.
Yeah.
But I do think Justin Hall is a bit of a whipping boy to this fan base. He is a mistake-prone guy. There's no question about it. But he is the steadier of the two guys that I would trust in these situations right now. It's tough. It would be between those two.
Mm-hmm. But Liljegren-Chen, you mean?
No, I would say no, between Liljegren and Hall.
That okay.
It'd be a razor's edge for me in terms of who I'd be choosing. But when it comes to playoffs and this matchup, yeah, I'm gonna lean towards the guy that's played heavier minutes and who can kill penalties for you and do some of those things, right?
Yeah.
So, that's the way I see it right now. But it's tough. It's tough balancing those out. And then there are nights where you see Luke Shen bring that physicality and you go, damn, you really want to have that in your lineup. Or I've seen Gustafsson step in and he's walking the blue line, he's stepping into the middle of the ice, and he's snapping passes, and I go, damn, it'd be nice if he could be a little bit a part of this. Yep. Ultimately, these problems get resolved very, very quickly if Liljegren can find a way out of this slump.
Yeah.
And it's been an understated story because I think for a long time, people were overly critical of Liljegren, and there's always been sort of he's a bit of a Nylander figure in that the people that didn't like him were being too extreme, and the people that liked him were being too extreme as well.
Right.
And so I think people generally try to avoid conversations about players like that because they just go, I don't want to get into this. I don't want to get into this because you're so far in your camp that I'm not going to pull you into this.
Like he's either a Norris candidate or he's
the worst. That's what I'm saying. There are people that are listening to me right now even deliver this take and they're freaking out. They're going, I cannot believe you would have Liljegren underneath Justin Hall. And I'm going, yeah, not as an overall player, but as someone with when it comes to fit, that's going to be the case. And yeah, that I think that the Leafs front office has indicated the same thing to you. If you believe that it's a front office that's intelligent, deserves an extension, all this different stuff, well, they also had those numbers that Ian had.
Yeah.
In fact, they've got better ones than Ian has.
Mm-hmm.
And
they have every number.
And they still made these decisions about their hockey team. They wanted to give their hockey team a different look come playoffs.
Yeah.
And yes, it is a gamble. There's certainly a risk to it. But overall, I don't know if it is a bias because this is sort of what I wanted to see and a lot of hockey fans want to see is them add players like the ones that they added and look like a different group. But yeah, if this continues, this trend for the rest of the season where they're getting outshot and outplayed a lot of different nights, I don't know if you're going to have that same feeling of confidence going into the postseason.
Yeah.
Anyway, weird that doesn't feel like John Tavares' night, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
Say. Yeah. That him going to play in New York.
He's
going
to get booed.
It's going to be weird, but yeah, just
I haven't seen anything about it.
No, it's completely under the radar.
Yeah, it's weird. Normally, you'd see some articles written about it or something, and
or there'd be like those odd tweets of like, you know, tonight the Leafs and the Islanders, John Tavares is going back, but there's been none of that.
Yeah,
very odd. If this is the NBA, it'd be everywhere. Like that return would be.
It's a bit of a. I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to ask other people, like, hey, you've been feeling this? And they go, no.
It's a missed opportunity.
Well, he's going to get booed, and then it'll be, we'll remember as we're watching the game, because those Islanders fans are going to be on him. But yeah, it's felt like a pretty small story. Anyway, let's take a quick break, and let's hit what we missed.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Fun show today. I really liked talking to Haberstroh. And it's good to get the data, good to get the numbers. You know what's the best part about it? Those guys do all the homework.
Yeah.
I just have to NAS them what the questions are.
That's pretty good.
I go, hey, what's the answer to this? And then those dorks come on here and they go, blah, 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 blah.
Like cheating off the nerds.
Yes.
And that's what's amazing.
Give me everything for free.
That's perfect.
Nothing.
You got a good thing going.
So you're welcome, audience, for my sneaky genius of getting smarter people to tell us the smart things. And now, hopefully, some of you end up trying to regurgitate some of this stuff to your friends and fumbling it extremely hard.
Oh, I can't wait to do that.
You gotta be just trying to capture one or two things from those smart people and then try to work on it, refine it, and then be able to spit that out. And if you can just do the one, you're good. You know,
I have like, the OG defensive metrics in my head.
What do you got?
Say it back
to us. Hey, Joe, what's the case for OG Anunoby's Defensive Player of the Year Award this year?
So an estimated plus minus OG Anunoby. Among players who have played 30 minutes or more per game, OG Anunoby is first place in the NBA. Brook Lopez is ninth.
Wow.
Damn.
That's pretty good.
That's a good stat by you, Joe.
Thanks.
You
I invented did. It myself.
Yeah, that you
There's
researched.
Nothing worse than Nobody when you're trying that. To like regurgitate something and you biff it.
Yeah.
And then the person you're telling is like, I don't think that's right. And all yeah. of a sudden you're like,
Sports is supposed to be the easy one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where do you think it ranks in terms of the most embarrassing ones of that you can do? For me, it's when people try to tell you a stand-up comics joke.
Oh, that's
And
sucks.
I think you'll see this too, okay? Because I love stand-up comedy. Yeah. And you'll try to sell someone on a bit.
I think everyone's done it at least once.
Or something will come up in real life and you'll say, this is just like the Nate Bargatze like joke where, and then you try to do it. And they go, that sounds like that comic sucks.
It's just not funny
at all.
There is
no comic on earth of any quality or caliber that wants you doing their material as a selling point for their work. Not a single one. I'd say that's number one for me.
Trying to retell a comics joke.
Yeah, number two is when it's the, this is a recency bias thing, but it was people trying to give you pandemic / COVID numbers. And I'm talking about either side of the aisle here.
Yeah.
People go, did you know how many vaccine injuries there? I'm like, do you really?
Does anyone?
They go, do you know how many people? They go, yeah, I don't want to hear any COVID stats from you. I get it. You got a website or a tweet that you didn't read anything further on. And you captured that to basically support the side of the aisle that you sit on. And anytime the conversation comes up, you go, did you know? You go,
people do that in sports too.
Forgot. Yeah, but for sports, that's what I'm saying. It's inconsequential. I know that people think it is now for whatever reason. Whenever that happened to shift where all of a sudden everyone became a sports hardo and we started to get really offended by takes and opinions.
Like opinions, debates.
Well, actually, the weird one for me is sometimes I'll get people go, this is a bad take. And I'll go, this isn't even really a take.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's amusing.
Just relaying
Austin
said
to me yesterday, he called me out and I was really sad.
Yeah, I know. But the thing is that you're kind of justified yelling at Austin for takes because he's so aggressive and he'll change what you say about something. And yeah, he's just
Simon witnessed it.
He'll just Austin, you know you'll do it where you will assassinate somebody.
Flanderous and not true.
You will Austin will come off the top rope. You'll try to explain something to him calmly, and then he'll just come right back at you, twisting your words loudly. It's actually pretty effective.
It's great.
I've yet
to argue.
See the calm JD still though.
You've yet to see the calm JD? Buddy, calm JD is every day when I don't fire you. Like, welcome.
Fair.
Welcome.
He's accepted.
Every single day where I go, it's okay. It's okay. I love the energy. I love the energy he brings. All right, what did we miss?
So I'm wondering if you're going to be calm JD if Joey Votto ever ends up as a Toronto Blue Jay.
Yeah, I'm good with it.
So Cincinnati Reds general manager Nick Kral was on a GM's Corner with Jim Bowden and Steve Phillips, and he said that if their plan is that Votto finishes career as a Red, however, if the Reds are out of it at the trade deadline and Votto came to them and asked if he would trade them to the Toronto Blue Jays, he said he would consider those circumstances.
We had the clip, Joe. You made Austin work for nothing, so that's cool.
No, I'm sorry, Austin. Yeah. I apologize.
Glad we
it was
read
a pretty
it.
Short thing, so I just
okay,
read it.
Here's the thing. The context here obviously really matters. This is Jim Bowden and them asking him. What's the show called?
GM's Corner. On SiriusXM.
They're asking him flat out on SiriusXM, hey, would you trade Joey Votto under these circumstances? Normally, though, guys plead the fifth there. It's a little interesting that they reference it that way. But again, they were asked within the framework of that question. I have a really tough time seeing a scenario where Joey Votto ends up a Toronto Blue Jay even still. The Reds are going to suck.
Yeah.
The Reds are going to be good this year. That's not a thing. We're not waiting on that. Yeah. Joey Votto is a really old player coming off of an injury who has shown significant signs of decline. The Blue Jays also signed Brandon Belt. Unless Brandon Belt gets hurt, they really don't have a need for a Joey Votto. Like, is that what you guys think this team is missing? If they go into the deadline this year and they need to acquire somebody, barring a bounce back from Votto, him explicitly wanting to go here, the Reds eating a bunch of the money, which why they would want to get off him in the first place, I don't really see the scenario that fits. This is just your classic, oh, he's from here, so you guys are making this correlation. And we did this in the past. I remember this has been an Ennis hobby horse for forever. I'm actually excited to do Good Hour with him this week and discuss his level of excitement when he saw this. Because, boy, he must have been horned up for this. He's like, yes, finally, Joey, my number one guy. I don't see a fit. I don't think it's what the Blue Jays need. I don't think it's how they would use their assets. And Yeah, I just, I don't know where Joey Votto would
39 years
play.
Old.
They want to have a like a moving DH. He's not playing first base.
Yeah.
So where does Joey Votto fit into this roster? Anyway, I don't see it. What's next?
If it does happen, there will be a lot of videos of him taking the subway to games and stuff.
Oh, my goodness. So. JD's favorite.
No, I don't think he would do that if that was the case.
I don't think so.
No, because if he got traded here, he would become... That's the thing about baseball players is nobody knows. This was always actually a great Bill Simmons bit from back in the day, was he would talk about how nobody knows who baseball players are because they wear the actual disguise. If you went into a shop and you were a celebrity, you'd wear a baseball cap and sunglasses, and that's their outfit every single day.
Every day,
yeah. Nobody knows. So, and it was a great, great take. And it's true, right? There's so many baseball players that could walk in, not to Sportsnet, that play for the Jays.
Yeah.
Right.
But once you become a Blue Jay, you become famous in this country. So Joey Votto can walk the streets.
Your faces on the side
people
of the stadium.
People will notice him. They'll give him his space. If he's a Toronto Blue Jays player, people are going to know. You don't think Vladdy gets on the subway, people are freaking out, different. Anyway, what's next?
Sorry to throw this at you, by the way. This just came across my desk, but apparently slam ball is coming back. Any quick thoughts on slam ball?
I loved slam ball, but I also feel like this is one of those things where it was probably better just left in the time capsule.
I think you're right. Yeah. That was my take too. Cause like I, like you, loved it when I was a kid, you know, you're whatever. How old are we? 12 or 13 or whatever.
Like that Spike TV. I was watching that and Scrappers, which was amazing. I've referenced Scrappers so many times. Just New York guys going out, drifting scrap metal from different places and fighting with each other. It was I swear.
That's such a bro show.
Some streaming service, get Scrappers. I need it. I miss it.
I wonder, is Scrappers on
anything right
now?
Spike TV, Pros versus Joes, Scrappers.
It had a good run.
Yeah, it was amazing. Spike TV was legit. Shaped a lot of, I watch a lot of Spike TV. This might shock you, but I was a big Spike TV guy. Anyway, Slam Ball was cool. And I enjoyed it, but I didn't exactly... It was something that you would throw on and kind of watch, and it was sweet for the highlights. Mm-hmm. And it was also during an era where we were way more in the just beat the living crap out of someone, put them in the hospital as sick in sports.
Yeah.
And that component to it, I'm kind of curious about. The only way slam ball ends up being kind of cool or sort of works is if... We get like a guy who is supposed to be a name in the G League who just goes, about it. I'm going here.
Scoot Henderson goes to
Slam Ball. Or guys that were, you know, NFL dropouts decide they're going to.
Like some freak athletes.
You know how like T.O. for years was saying he could still play in the NFL? Yeah. Imagine T.O. just decided he was going to. But they'll have no money, right? So it'll be bums and it'll be kind of nothing. And
I missed the whole Slam Ball era.
That's what I'm saying. These things rarely, they do them again and then it turns out to be sick.
True. Like the rerun is better than
most extreme elimination. That was Spike TV show too.
Yeah.
That was sick.
MXC.
Yeah.
That was really good.
Yes.
Wow. What a run.
What an incredible.
You guys had such cool TV.
We did. Yeah. Cause you guys ruined it.
Disney.
You came in, you guys were like, we need to have personal channels for everything. And now
Netflix. Wizards of Waverly Place.
Yeah. Anyways, what's next?
So Adam Thielen signed with the Panthers and he cited Andy Dalton as one of the reasons that he signed there, which
apparently
I mean,
Andy Dalton is the man. Everybody likes Andy Dalton.
Look, as a ginger, you know, who loves to see gingers succeed
ginger
in sports.
Is big,
also a Saints fan.
That's huge. I know.
So double whammy.
Except for you hated him as a Saint.
I did. So,
turn your back on him.
Really had to reconcile.
Judas.
That was a crushing blow for me. Clearly, that's a lie, though. I mean, come on, Andy Dalton. That's not why you signed with the Panthers. What's a player that you like once talked yourself into as a fan that kind of ended up busting? I was a believer in Hedo Turkoglu, and that did not.
Who wasn't a believer? Well. Hedo, though. That one, I think, is forgivable. Because that's a marquee. The Raptors signed no free agents. He was coming off of that run with Orlando.
Yeah.
He was basically revolutionizing point forward.
Point forward, yeah.
Uh-huh. You can't take heat for that.
Okay, hey, then I won't.
No, you can't. There are certain players that we all bought into that it's fine. Like, I don't think that, for example, David Clarkson counts in this category because, again, a marquee free agent that everybody knew got overpaid. And it got way too out of control when they were doing stuff like Wendell Clarkson.
Mm-hmm.
Wendell
Clarkson.
Yeah, that was a Toronto Sun headline, I want to say, or Toronto Star. One of the two papers ran with that one. They did a big feature on Clarkson, and it didn't work out. He had the injuries, whatever. But yeah, if it was a player of actual acclaim that you got on your team up here, I think that is, you know what's funny is the the guy that I was most excited for that didn't end up even happening was when the Raptors made that trade that got vetoed, where they were supposed to get Boris Diaw.
Oh,
and
sure.
I got really excited about having Boris Diaw on the Raptors and that fake Calderon trade that fell apart. But that one won't count. I'm trying to think of busty players that I really believed in that did not work out, and I kept trying to give the benefit of the doubt to. This is a problem for me because I'm usually kind of a pessimist when it comes to this stuff. Like, I look at signings, like, I'm trying to think of just recent busts like Tanner Roark, right? Where the Blue Jays signed him, and I went, what the hell is this? What are we
just
doing?
Out immediately.
Yeah, right? Jaime Garcia, I remember thinking was a pretty decent signing. I went, it's a one-year contract and can't really go bad with that. And then he was horrifically bad.
Frank Thomas?
I liked Frank Thomas, and Frank Thomas was better. He was better than I think a lot of us expected.
Fair.
He wasn't a horrific nightmare here. He was decent. I'm trying to think of guys that I was genuinely excited for that just sucked. Because Simon's right in that Haydu is one of those guys. David Clarkson would be one of those guys. Oh, I've got it.
Oh,
and I hate, well, no, marquee. It fits into my marquee thing, but kind of not. But, well, no. Actually, I've got a couple
Leafs. Are you going to say it?
Well, no, it just, I've said I think that he got a really raw deal because cancer, and we didn't really do enough justice covering that story properly with Jason Blake. But, yeah, I was at a candidate party in Ottawa at a kegger, and someone came out on a balcony and yelled, Jason Blake just signed with the Leafs. And we started chanting in Ottawa Senators fans, Jason Blake, Jason Blake. And I remember thinking, damn, this guy, finally, they got a sweet winger that's going to score a bunch of goals. He came off a 40-goal season. But I'm saying that fits too much in the Haydu category. I have the perfect guy for me. Jonas Gustafsson, the goaltender, the monster.
I was
all in on Jonas Gustafsson. And still to this day, I'm like, he was good.
You're like, still in denial.
100%. I've had a lot of goalies like that, though, throughout the days. I was a big Michael Telkvist guy. I really bought into Telly. I went, dude, this guy is the future of Swedish hockey and the future of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and you better believe that Telkvist is going to be a brick wall for the Toronto Maple Leafs. So I've just had goalies that were flyers that missed, but I was a huge Gustafsson guy. This is where nickname matters so much. He was nicknamed the monster and he had great lower pad movement and he had a sexy style and his nickname was the monster. And I was all in, like, unbelievably all in.
Yeah.
So that is definitely my guy where he fits the category of, to this day, I would, if I was the GM of the Leafs and they went, hey, Matt Murray got hurt, what should we do? I would say, what is Jonas Gustafsson doing? Is he around?
Do we still have his number somewhere?
Has he been skating lately?
I think he could do something for us. He could step in here. Anyways, what's next?
So there's a morning alarm debate's been floating around the internet lately where a girlfriend was very mad with her boyfriend because instead of setting an alarm for 7:30, he sets one for 7, keeps hitting snooze until he finally rolls out of bed.
Yeah.
She hates it. So I was wondering, what's your morning alarm schedule?
Okay.
Do you agree with the hitting snooze a couple times?
No.
Or are you one?
Okay. I just don't understand how this became... What happened? Is this was a tweet? This was on TikTok?
It's a Reddit thing called... it's r/...
Oh, you found it on Reddit?
No, it's from The Mirror on UK where they ask people who read the magazine to submit stories. And this is one of them that got very viral and
I was surprised by it because this is just the life everyone lives. Yeah. That if you have, like, Simon, you're probably the authority here as the married guy taking your wife on a sweet honeymoon.
Okay,
with your
we
parents.
Don't have
with
to. We
parents.
Can just brush.
Yeah,
brush
it's cool.
By
yeah, it's cool guy. Are they paying for it too? They take you to dinner every night.
We're only with them for part of it, guys. There's also a part where we're
cool.
on our own.
They
okay?
literally made White Lotus, and you still did this move. My ex, she was a big multiple alarm person, drove me insane. I'm a big one alarm, you're up. I actually usually get up before my alarm and end up turning it off even before it happens.
You beat the system.
The people, yeah, I hate it. Usually, a lot of times I'll be in the shower and then I'll hear the alarm going off and I'll have to just be like, shut up, you know, I forgot
just
to turn
sit there
it off.
In the shower listening
to it. Yeah, because I'm already up earlier trying to get it done. Mm. If you're in a multiple alarm person, I think you should go to jail, move to jail immediately. Like, that's so horrific. It's so bad. Like, how many do you need? If you hit the snooze once and then you get up, that's okay. That's the people who do it 4 or 5 times,
for like half an hour.
Yeah, I know. How much time?
5 times every morning, man.
You're 5 times every morning?
5 times.
Again, hey, I rest my case. Austin, 5-time alarm guy, my number one candidate on the show for Moon Jail constantly. Like, yeah, of course you would be that guy.
5 times is insane.
5 times. That's
I have 2.
But doesn't it just aggravate you? Like, I hate the sound of an alarm.
Yeah. No, I got to go back to sleep. What are you talking
go
about?
Go back to sleep. No, you're up.
No.
Oh, it's 10-minute rest.
You set two.
Huge.
You wake up, and then the second one gets you out of bed, but you're already awake.
I don't know. I think that's a lunatic behavior. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave 5 stars. And then, yeah, hit me up at JD Bunkus with any of your thoughts on those topics. See you tomorrow. Will Buxton.
If you're in the mood